You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seats and tray tables are in their upright and locked position. The airlock has been sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse.
Woof, we dodged a bullet there, didn't we? We were just talking in the last episode about what I might have to do if the sound didn't work for the intro.
Yes, we did. And I also want to say, you know, because the music is a little bit rocker, right? I did that on purpose. I went, because we used to have like mellow singer-songwriter music, and now we have, you know, rocker. I did not know that Lita Ford still existed. I recently posted this on our patrons Facebook group. I did not know that she was still out there, did not know that she was still playing guitar and rocking crowds. And I just want to say, I think that's pretty cool.
I was so afraid that you were going to end this with, and we actually owe Lita Ford a bunch of money because we've been sampling her all
the time. No. I went the right way. I went and got licensed, and I went to the royalty website and did the licensing and got the music. Yes, we're fine.
Whew, okay, because I would have just turned to John here and said, John, I'm afraid you have to pay the royalties on this.
You want me to beatbox you a new entrance theme?
Right, yeah. Well, that's literally actually what we've been talking about with our previous week's guests. So you may recognize that laugh, listeners. And I hope you do, because we're back with John Wiswell here, who, in addition to continuing to be the wonderful mensch that he is, has collected some fantastic things since last we spoke. Locus Award, Nebula Award, Hugo nominee. I don't really have a way through the Digiverse to like, wow, I don't like, we don't have a, we probably don't have like on any applause loaded or something like that, or just, we'll just like, well done.
I don't have the crowd. I don't have the crowd.
That probably doesn't even sound like applause in the mic right now. I'm really sorry, listeners.
Well, I'm seeing the applause, and it means a lot, too.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's really good.
I have a question, because this just recently came up. John, were you at Worldcon in San Antonio?
San Antonio? Yes, I was.
Did you come to the SF Signal meetup at the Sparrow pizza thing in the food court?
Why, in fact, I did.
Okay, yes. So, it just so happens my oldest friend in the universe reached out to me and said, do I know an author named Adam Christopher? And I said, yes. And I went through my photos and I came up with one from that SF Signal meetup in San Antonio. And I'm looking at it and I'm like, wait a minute, is that John Wiswell like, waving at me? Like, I think there was like a point where you were sitting at another table and you just kind of waved as I was taking a photo.
Yep.
But I sent the picture to my friend. I'm like, yeah, this is Adam Christopher and he's a good writer and you should read his stuff. But yeah, it's just a funny kind of coincidence that we were going to have you on at the same time that I'm looking at old photos and there you are.
Small and big world at the same time.
Yeah, I loved that you folks did meetups like that, because I went to San Antonio knowing maybe two people who were going to that entire convention and flying across the country for it anyway. I remember keenly you were very kind to me, who was very shy. I didn't know anybody. I was still trying to understand the whole landscape of publishing and what anything was. I actually remember the last thing I did before I jumped in a car to go to the airport was I got to watch half of your panel on how to do a podcast. But I could only watch half before I had to go to the airport.
Yeah.
Oh, well, the secret half is what you missed.
Oh, that's right.
The best stuff. Yeah. That's the how to be a millionaire podcaster part was what you missed.
This feels like a million years ago, but what's kind of funny about that meetup is I told Leonardo, I said, I want to do a meetup. He's like, oh my God, why? And I'm like, no, it'll be good. Like, we'll have all these people and everybody show up. He's like, what if no one shows up? And I'm like, no, it's fine.
That's like the
and
most so, ancient nerd fear right
yeah.
there.
And what so if we no put one it comes out.
To my birthday party?
We put it out and we just kind of take over this little section of the food court. And Donardo's like, this is garbage unless we have food. We got to get food. And I'm like, we don't need food. He's like, no, we need food. I'm like, dude, we don't need food. And then he goes over to Sparrow and starts like ordering pizzas.
Word.
And bringing pizzas over. And people are just sitting there eating the pizzas. They're like, oh, cool. Food too? Really?
Yeah. You're providers. You can provide. Yeah.
And you had people who were from all across the exposure spectrum, right? Like,
yeah.
So you flattened the hierarchy of the convention for a bunch of people who otherwise would have no way of socializing like that. It really sets an example that I try to hold up now when I go to conventions, be as public as possible and just treat everybody like they're a person.
Yeah, I took that because DiNardo was really big about networking and like just introducing people to people. And that became a thing that I do. And I took that to my local con, Mile High Con, where we would do the Friday night writers meetup in the bar. And it was like a sanctioned thing by the convention. Like it became part of the programming where myself and some other people would just host, and writers were encouraged to come and just talk to each other and have a drink and just hang out. And did that for many, many, many years until COVID. Like, yeah. I think that's when it kind of died. But yeah, so fun times. Anyway, Tracy, we've completely derailed everything that you wanted to do.
Oh, whatever. Like, this is the democracy of chaos as it is meant to be. So it's sort of hard to put a finger on like what is the best opportunity we have here, John, to talk about everything that's going on with you, because you are, of course, coming out of the giant, giant success that was Someone You Could Build a Nest In. Earlier this year, we had Wearing the Lion, which I would love to talk to you about. And if I'm not preempting anything for you here, you're working on Dragon Book, yes?
Oh, yes. Yes, I am.
So much book, such wow. And I mean, going back to let's pick up with Wearing the Lion, because we talked to you before about Someone You Could Build a Nest In, and I thought to myself as I was reading it and talking to people about it, this is really going to land with people, and Lordy, it sure did, which is fantastic. But I think Wearing the Lion is a text that's moving in a really different direction, while at the same time being highly Wiswellian, if I may. So do you mind briefing people on Wearing the Lion?
My pleasure. Yes. As opposed to Someone You Could Build a Nest In, which was your typical cozy horror, romanticy, body, monstrosity, fantasy.
As one does.
Yes, right. Yes, everybody writes those all the time. Wearing the Lion is a remix of various Greek myths, and particularly focusing on the legends of Hera and Heracles. Hera, one of the most famous gods, yet doesn't get to be the main character almost ever. And Heracles, Zeus's best boy, the strongest man in the world, son of Zeus and a woman he's not married to, who I wrote as being highly reverent of his auntie Hera. He grows up with this love of family. This is rooted in part because the name Herakleos in ancient Greek means the glory of Hera. They named him that to try to calm Hera down. Say, like, really, just, I know you're not really going to be into this, but take a look at this kid. And they raise him to be extremely reverent of her. And he's heard these myths about how much of a nightmare Hera is, but he thinks, you just don't understand my auntie Hera. And so he keeps being sent on these missions to battle wars and great beasts and surviving, and then praising Auntie Hera for giving him the strength to get through this. Meanwhile, up in Olympus, Hera's like, God damn it, he lived. And it turns out that Hera may has been sending him on these missions to get him killed and is not giving him the strength to make it through things. And this sort of one-sided rivalry with him just loving her more, the more she tries to kill him, maybe goes, let's say, just a smidge too far. Something one might say is Greek mythological level of tragedy might happen. And so it's this story of two points of view on this changing point in the history of Greek mythology that I just loved writing, because these two characters are so utterly different, and yet I love them both deeply.
I guess that's, for me, one of the points of fascination here is how you're kind of trying to navigate this tipping point between having a sense of kind of tender and often tongue-in-cheek sort of humor with the predicament of Heracles, to which he's largely unaware that he even has a predicament, and then Hera as his antagonist, and also treating very seriously the fact that there is a deep trauma that ends up being part of Heracles' journey here that is part of how you upend the original mythology, that there's much that we expect of Heracles, the Nemean lion and so on. We expect him to just go punch things, go tear more stuff up. You are Heracles, go wreck things. And after he experiences this profound trauma, he ends up swinging this completely different direction. So we have this kind of tenderness and also lightheartedness and also this tragedy that you're on this absolute balancing act about. And wow. I have to wonder, for you reading this, writing this, reading it back to yourself, like, how did you try to manage that?
Because one of the reasons that I wrote Wearing the Lion is I wanted to do the other side of Someone You Could Build a Nest In. So Someone You Could Build a Nest In is the story of a monster finding that she could have family with people. And I wanted to do the other side, which is a person who winds up feeling monstrous in his trauma, who feels like he doesn't belong among people, and then finding that the monsters of the world understand how he feels. And they are someone he can commune with. They're people he can commune with. They are not just a big, scary bull. I feel like a big scary bull too, and I would like to hug the big scary bull. And so, you know, the first battle is the go get the skin of the Nemean lion, and he's just like, well, I don't want to hurt anybody with my hands ever again after the trauma that he's been through. Strength is not the answer to any of his problems. And yes, he could throw it into the sun, but he doesn't want to hurt anyone ever again. And I wanted to write a masculine character like that anyway, somebody who. For whom violence is kind of abhorrent, because that's sort of the way I live. But also the idea that gentleness towards creatures who have always been hurt might yield character growth for them and found family for us all. And I love me a good found family. And it turns out that if I get a found family of a giant lion and a giant bull and a nerdy hydra, I'm living my best life. And so is Heracles in his own way. So a lot of the balance is that we all carry pain with us. We all have struggled. We all have trauma. And that isn't the end of goodness in your life. That there's the potential. There's still value in you. There's still things that people find beautiful inside of you, even if you don't see them or can't see them. And you may be surprised by the people who can. And that is the leaving a shell that was very familiar for people who liked Shishashin. And that's a deep part of Heracles. And I got to say, a deep part of Hera, right? Hera herself is actually held back by her myth of being at the top of the universe. Which is funny. You'd think, well, there's nothing she can't reach. But actually, that position is preventing her from being everything that the people who love her believe she is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, and not to, this is a perfect opportunity to talk about Hera, because you're right. As I think about how you talked about the vision of the book, I probably have spent in my childhood obsession with Greek mythology the least amount of time paying attention to or caring about Hera. Like, Hera's function was to be the shrewish wife who is always taking her dysfunctional relationship with Zeus out on the objects of Zeus's passion. And
Hey, Hera is the pilot of the Ghost. No, that's a different story. Different universe. That's Star Wars. Never mind. Keep going.
Yeah. So, now for something completely different.
A man with a tape recorder up his nose.
That one. Yeah. So I guess, like, in thinking about, like, you were trying to give this tenderness and this different vision of masculine strength to Heracles, but we're also trying to, in essence, liberate Hera from the kind of mythology that surrounds her of being the bitchy wife. Yeah. And I'm kind of wondering which is harder.
You know, it's funny because both are easier than you think when you approach them as people rather than as legends. The secret for me and my favorite kind of Greek mythological retelling is finding a person inside of a story that's bigger than a person. Because doing so in legacies and mythologies, they're inherently dehumanizing while they embellish what makes us human, which is a beautiful trade-off, but the arts compel us to challenge that and play with that. So at first, you know, I was more afraid of messing up Hera because there aren't enough Hera stories. I just wanted to contribute, because Hera is so often a Hera-shaped hole in a story rather than a person in a story, which I detest. I've always found that very obnoxious. Even in most versions of the Heracles myths, she shows up at the beginning, she hates him, and then she, you know, annihilates his family, and then she checks out. And maybe she shows up when he dies to give him a new wife and say she's sorry. And I'm like, okay, that's 25 years or 45 years, depending on the mythologer. What's she doing in the rest of that time? What is her life? What is her existence? Who are the people she talks to? What are the humans she's interested in? What are her values? What's actually going through her head? Because otherwise, a lot of Hera's stories just read like slander of somebody that Zeus doesn't like very much, which is funny. Maybe that reflects some of the people who are writing down the myths back then. And so I think a big element was finding the people around both Hera and Heracles who define them. Megara challenges Heracles' simple ideas of the world, the woman who becomes his wife and has her own journey. The Furies, who look upon Hera as a grandchild, and who see things in her. These potentials that other people see in us that we don't recognize in us were the great guides for figuring out, well, who are these people and how can they grow? And then the most fun is putting Hera and Heracles next to each other, because they have very strong opinions about each other. And at first they're very wrong, but as they grow as people, they start to grow into what each of them thinks about the other, that they might be living up to the expectations of people who think highly or low of them based on where they are in their lives. And you're still very worried you're going to mess up an important thing, because these are myths that I love very dearly. You know, some of the first stories that my parents read to me back before I could even read back at night would be, you know, the tall tales from Native American folklore, Greek mythology, ancient Chinese myths and war stories. And so I have always wanted to examine what is it like to live these stories? What is it like to be a person rather than a couple of sentences that fly by three decades at a time?
Yeah.
It's very fun.
I mean, it should be fun too. Okay, so this is a question for all three of us. And if everybody needs some time to think about it, then that's fair. We can revisit the question later and like table it. But I'm thinking about Heracles' solution to these challenges being I will air quote defeat these challenges in this nonviolent way. And he ends up sort of having this like posse of critters that have become his homeboys. And so I want to know, from the world of mythology or the larger world of storytelling broadly, who's the critter that you'd want to be part of your posse? So Patrick, do you know? Do you need a minute? Do we need to is it fair for Chewie to be a critter? I guess. Okay, he's critter. He's critter. Okay. Yeah.
He's critter like.
I mean, come on.
Here's what I want to know. Would you want to be able to understand Wookiee as a precondition of this? Okay. All right. So you speak Wookiee and it's Chewie. Got it.
Yes.
Okay. All right. John, how about you?
Sure. So the real difficulty here is picking only one.
I know, right? Hence the posse.
I might want to adopt literally all of them. Even if they'll all kill me, I kind of want all of them. But I will say, I have a weird fondness for J.R.R. Tolkien's Smaug, that horrible dragon that lives in that mountain. I'll give my explanation. My defense of this horrible beast who must be slain is... You know what? A giant grump who just doesn't want to leave his house and wants to sleep all the time really speaks to me as a man who struggles with depression. And I feel like, you know, some people watch a rom-com and say, I could fix him. I see Smaug and I'm like, I could fix him. Me and some Zoloft could fix him. Let's just talk it out, bud. I know you're going to eat me if you can see me, but just like, let's talk this out. I could bring my Xbox over to the mountain and the two of us could hang out in there and maybe we could talk through some issues. So I think if I could be friends with Smaug the Dragon, that would be at least an interesting end of times for me.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. I mean, you'd go out a hero one way or the other.
So, Tracy, who's your new BFF?
Oh, my gosh. I go with Lion Cat from Saga.
Nice.
Because I have very low tolerance for bullshit. Like, I can I can handle it if the kind of bullshit that people feed you because they're unwilling to talk to you about difficult things, or the bullshit that people feed you because they're trying to get one out. Like, I just, my bullshit tolerance is like a negative sum.
Fair.
It's not great. And I feel like Lion Cat and I would really get along great. And also, I'm not bullshit immune. Like, I throw my own bullshit around sometimes, and I think I would appreciate Lion Cat keeping me straight. yeah. So me and Lion Cat going around checking all the haters.
Can I
throw being the haters, I guess.
And given our luck, collectively, we would all end up with Schnarf.
Oh. Oh.
God.
Can
I have Marma instead?
Okay.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Wait. If Chewbacca is a critter, then is Lion-O a critter?
Ooh. I don't know. I was actually thinking about Chitara, but that's just a different. Oh, that's a different conversation completely.
That might get a little uncomfortable.
all right. Yeah. I got to throw out an honorable mention, though. I was only allowed to adopt one monster as my BFF, true. But I would like to just hug Appa, the giant sky bison from Avatar.
Appa was in my head for a minute, and then I realized that, at a certain point, there's something about me that Appa wouldn't quite speak to. Although, ooh, would I want to totally hang with Appa? I want to take a vacation with Appa. That'd be cool. And I don't even mean he has to fly me places. I mean, I just want to hang out somewhere with Appa.
Yeah.
And just give him some time off and be there to watch him enjoy it. That'd be good.
Yeah. I just want to hug him. Literally, I want to disappear anime style into the fur, and then I will let him go. Because we know that he is meant to be with Aang and Katara. That you separate him from them, and it's the saddest part of the show. So
it's terrible. It's
just
like 5 or 6
him.
Episodes of agony.
Yeah. When he got stolen. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's bad stuff.
I would never steal Appa.
Yeah. No, no. You're just visitation. Just
also, Smog probably won't like him. So keep him away from the mountain.
I'm having no trouble visualizing at all the face smash into Appa that you're doing here. So I'm going to assume that whatever type of, I mean, he's a sky buffalo. And so clearly that means that he's not cat adjacent. Cause I remember that cats are murderously.
That's
Tracy. Tracy. Yeah. I just have to say this because you're embarrassing yourself right now.
Yeah.
Bison.
Okay.
He's a sky bison.
Sky bison. Right. You're right. Damn. Count on the guy from Colorado to clear me up on bison. Right? Excuse me. That
get it right.
Ruminant,
come on.
Different hooved ruminant. I'm actually struggling. This is not related to books or the world of fantasy or anything. This is just straight up reality here. One of our cats passed away very unexpectedly in May. And about a month later, we adopted another cat who has largely, after a lot of travail, successfully integrated into the household. But there is a real problem that I have with this cat whose name is Opus. And the problem I have with Opus is that he hates being picked up. And I'm not the sort of person who wants to carry a cat around like a baby. I know they don't like that. They shouldn't have to put up with that bullshit. But I would like to, for at least functional purposes, to be able to pick up a cat to move them from point A to point B or something and not have it turn into a federal case. Although apparently everything's a federal case now, if you want it to be. That's a whole other thing. But the other thing is he's really cute. He's a little tuxedo guy. I saw somebody recently make a comparison online and said that tuxedo cats are the huskies of cats. Huh. And I thought to myself, okay, that tracks, because he's kind of bitchy and also hyperactive. And this kind of makes sense. he's just this complete mess. All the time I look at him and I'm like, I just want to pick you up and smash my face into your belly and you would end me. and so my love language with him is just looking at him and saying, I want to pick you up and smash my face into your fur, but I'm not going to. And none of that means anything to him, but that's, if the whole as you wish is what he really meant was I love you. That is my as you wish to this fucking cat. Who will apparently never be my Appa.
And see, I every 2 weeks I go to Giles and Emily's house to play D&D. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I walk in, Edmund, who is a very old and cantankerous cat at this point, like he makes his presence known.
Yes.
As soon as I walk in, he like comes down the stair. Wow! Wow! Yeah. And the whole thing is, it's time for me to pick him up.
Yeah, okay.
And I pick him up and I swoop him baby style. Mm-hmm. And I just start petting him, and he puts his claws into my arm, and he just kind of holds my arm in place as I'm petting him. So I just want you to know that I get to pick up a cat
and pet him. My other cat, Hobbs, who is here off camera, which is completely non-valuable information to our listeners here. You're welcome. He's cool with me pick. I can kind of do whatever with him. His superpower is he has no fucks to give. his superpower is... clearly you've done nothing wrong to me at this point. I trust you in all things. That is, and considering that he was rescued out of a Taco Bell dumpster, I think he's probably seen enough
well,
stuff.
See, but every
he's
time,
like, this is all better.
Every time someone tells me they have a cat that doesn't like to be picked up, doesn't blah, blah, like, it never works with me.
Mm.
Like, I picked that cat up. Because Edmund was like that at first. They were like, he didn't like being picked up. And I just started picking
him
up. So
what you're saying is you need to come to Chicago and pick up
Opus?
And
just teach him. Yeah. Just teach him. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, then
this
is your...
That's my superpower.
All right. John, do you have a critter taming superpower? Like, in reality or in your fantasies?
I feel like I am the Mr. Glass of animal taming superpowers in that I am profoundly allergic to almost everything. So I am very grateful that there are people out there who don't have my super anti-power. And are out there doing the important work of petting dogs and cats and fish and tortoises. In my fiction, I get to pet the monster, right? Yeah. I get to give them the all of the hugs that I can't give them in the real world.
Sure.
There you go. Yeah. I sort of feel like if I had a Wiswellian level of imagination here, that there would be like a novelette out there for me to write where I could have a character who is profoundly allergic to all of the ordinary domestic critters, but in this particular world, there are like xenocritters of various types, and you know, cryptocritters of various types that nobody thinks too much of, but they also are sort of like overpopulated and ill cared for, and operates like an animal rescue for those.
Yeah,
like he's got his little chimera over here, and like here's the little, we got the baby griffins, but we have to feed them with the puppet so that they don't imprint on us, and you know, the whole I feel like there's a thing that could be done there.
I love that. Yeah, the closest I've done to that is earlier this year, I had a short story out called An Asexual Succubus, and she runs a monster pet store where she is finding the right owners for all of these. Because, you know, like a Cerberus puppy, or as she calls them, triple puppies, they're very demanding, and the three heads all want to be petted at the same time. So your typical two-handed client really can't handle the needs of a triple puppy. Similarly, you need a really cagey owner for the Mogwai, especially if you're the kind who might snack after midnight.
Yeah. Good food and discipline.
Yeah. So I've been doing my monster care mostly through fiction. There was a period where my sister left her cat with us for a period of years, which was very challenging for me. What I would do is I would lay a blanket over myself. And then I would put like three layers of mittens and socks over my hands and let him like lie on me proximately and pet him just so he wouldn't be lonely. But it was like, it was tenuous for us. I remember this, the first time there was a big storm, I went downstairs just to be like, it's all right. It's all right. And he ran over because he's like, thank God, a human's alive. And he looked up the stairs and he saw me and his face immediately like, oh no, he's the one who lived.
Not the mummy man.
Yeah, it's
that one.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is there anything worse than being a disappointment to an animal? I swear. Like, they want so little, if you really think about it in the grand scheme of things. Like if I dogs, for the most part, this isn't too much of an issue because dogs tend to be fairly egalitarian about these things. You know, they'll come tearing around the corner when someone comes home and look at you like, it's you, even if they've never met you before. It's so great. Who are you? But for, you know, for cats, there's definitely, they like to choose favorites. And I am Hobbs's favorite. Opus, Deirdre, my daughter, is his favorite. Fortunately, because I do all the feeding, unless I'm like incommunicado or not available in some way, both the cats are like, "Wee, it's you," anytime they see me. So Opus is willing to fake it for the sake of the num-nums. But yeah, in all other situations, he's like, "Oh.
Yeah.
You, is it? Is this all there is then?" He gets very philosophical seeming.
Understood.
So, oh my gosh. Well, I've already had you picking things like critters and whatnot, but technically that doesn't count as picks of the week, but this does.
We'll get to picks of the week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. Take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear, picks of the week.
All right. Patrick, pick of the week?
I'm on a roll. So last week I picked a Paizo thing. I'm picking another Paizo thing.
Nice.
Today. This is, Paizo released Starfinder 2nd Edition at Gen Con this year. And as part of that, what they've done is, again, just like a starter box, they have released a Starfinder 2nd Edition deluxe adventure called Murder in Metal City.
Ooh.
Ooh.
And this is a game night thing. Like, if you have folks that you want to introduce to Starfinder, but they can't commit to a campaign or they're on the fence about it, you can do this and you can get them just like a one shot kind of thing. And actually it's got more than that in it. It's got stuff that like you can do multiple things, but this one's bigger than the one I talked about last week. This has a 64 page book with an adventure for first level characters. And then 6 pre-gen characters, GM guide, flip map. So you have your dungeon and stuff ready to go. You have combat tokens for the players and the foes and stuff in there. You've got investigation handouts and cards that have the NPCs and the gear on it. And it's all about this thing that happens, and you kind of got to investigate it. There's a murderer. And but it teaches you about Starfinder and how to play the game and the setting and everything. It's really, really neat. It's a much thicker box than the one I showed you last week, Tracy.
Yeah.
And it's just got all kinds of cool stuff in it. And that's super cool. I think it's great for a game night with friends. Mm-hmm. And it's got everything you need. And you just do it. No?
No.
No.
No? There was a big thunderclap, and I got very afraid. Oh, I'm sorry.
For context here, fair not listeners, Patrick is going to have done a lot of extra editing to bring this episode to you, because poor John is just being pummeled by storms off where he lives, and the storms keep eating his internet connection. And so it has been a brave battle of one man now against the storm, and another one soon against what the storm left behind.
Why we have him, John? What's your pick this week?
Yeah, let's go.
Well, thank you all for being so patient with me. My pick is a lovely new indie video game called Herdling,
which
came out from a Swiss team called Okamotive, who are just wonderful geniuses of game design around your connections to inanimate or sometimes animate creatures. Herdling, their newest game, is where you are a wayward shepherd who is trying to find all of these lost, abandoned, or otherwise stranded, I would say Muppet bison. Of the most huggable things.
Not Muppet Buffalo.
Not Muppet Buffalo. No, absolutely never Muppet Buffalo. Goodness. But these things that are huge and adorable. Some of them are newborn babies. Some of them are elders of their kind. And you are gathering them all together to help them get out of the dangers of the city and the countryside and where there are predatory animals. and find them there, bring them back to their homeland.
Nice.
And so you are creating this adorable, fluffy found family. But it is the challenge of being their shepherd, which means they don't go where you want them to. You are trying to do your best with hungry, scared, confused animals and making them happy and taking care of them and feeding them and sometimes skating down mountainsides on their backs. It's an adorable, beautiful hug of a video game.
Right. That's cool. Awesome. That sounds super cool. Oh my gosh.
I was today years old when I found out there's a game that you can play on Xbox where you are working the job as a power washer.
Okay.
And you just go around accepting jobs, power washing houses, play
yards. This is absolutely somebody's ASMR fixed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's your job. And
that's amazing.
Now, if we could just combine the two and you're like
you're
a bison power wash. Yeah.
Bison people. Yeah.
Here's the thing. Like, I don't even power wash in real life.
Yes.
So why would I do it in virtual? I don't know. Anyway, Tracy.
I don't know. People have needs. People give people what they want. So this is kind of adjacent to the whole like critters of various kinds. But in this case, we have the anthropomorphized critter people of the Stan Sakai universe. Ooh. I've been reading the first volume of the Usagi Yojimbo.
Nice.
Yay.
Yeah. And so this is the collected works of Stan Sakai from the Usagi Yojimbo universe, which for those of you who don't know, begins with a little bit of a wink and a nudge towards the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles verse, but exists really separate from it, is meant to exist separate from it in its own sort of narrative space. It's a really kind of fascinating work that kind of fuses his very particular charming, but also sometimes strikingly gritty artistic style with this narrative that's very much rooted in a kind of re-envisioning of feudal Japan and the kind of like Tokugawa sort of shogunate sort of era. And so it's really been an incredible read. So if you can get your hands on Usagi Yojimbo Saga Volume 1, I highly recommend it. I got it from my local library.
Yeah, nice. I will second that. It is a delightful read.
Any plans to try to track down the adolescent radioactive hamsters?
No, I'm going to leave them alone. They seem
that's
like
a real
they
thing.
Need, they got some growing up to do yet.
I didn't make that up.
No.
That's a real thing.
Yeah. No, I get enough time with adolescents with the with the ones that actually belong to me and then the ones that I am sort of legally bound to teach. So
I can't remember
I'm good.
If it was the adolescent radioactive hamsters or black belt hamsters or if it was like – I know Robert's going to tell me, but it was it like the radioactive adolescent black belt hamsters?
That one sounds right.
Called. I think that's what it was called.
Yeah, the cadence on it sounds right.
Yeah,
so.
And it was a, hey, people like these turtles. Let's come up with our own thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, people dig themselves some ninja critters. So, yeah. All right, John Wiswell, it has been awesome having you. We didn't even touch on Dragon Book yet, which I guess means that we're going to have you back. So in the not too distant future, I'm sure there are many things coming up for you in the writing verse and otherwise. Where can people find you and the cool stuff that you're doing?
Thank you so much for having me. As always, it's lovely to be here and What Fantasy Author Minds a Sequel? Can't wait to come back. You can find me around the internet. I'm on Blue Sky at Wiswell. I'm on Instagram at John_Wiswell. And I have a newsletter. It's just johnwiswell.substack.com.
Fantastic. All right, John. So do your best to weather that storm, hopefully without having to rescue a cat as part of it.
Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.